I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our question this hour is, what does good child care look like, and what could good child care reform look like? Many scientists have said that children's experiences in the first 5 years of life really do make a huge difference in how well a child learns later on, how they progress in school. So high-quality early care and education for all children is critical. But in a new report, What Does Good Child Care Reform Look Like?, the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment writes that many peer nations provide universal affordable child care through subsidies, extensive pre-kindergarten programs, paid family leave. But the American system is deeply fragmented and severely undersourced. Marcy Whitebook is with us, director of the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment at UC Berkeley. She taught in early childhood programs for many years and was the founding executive director of the Washington-based Center for the Child Care Workforce. She has led several large-scale early childhood research projects, and we're delighted to have her with us this hour. And we're interested in your situation as well. Many of you have children who are in child care, or you've recently had children or grandchildren who are in child care, or you work within the system and can talk about the low wages of people who work in the field. But it's a very difficult issue that we keep saying we have to do something about, and then year after year we say the same thing. We have to do something about this, and then we don't do anything about it. Marcy is our guest this hour. Hi, Marcy. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk with you this morning.
Yeah, our pleasure. When you say, I'm just interested in our peer nations, so we can start at a point where we look at where we what we have or don't have and what other countries have. When you talk about peer nations providing so much better than what we provide, tell me more about those nations and why they do so much in this area.
Sure. I think there's a few ways to think about it. Like in many, many countries, in countries all over the world, people are interested in ensuring that children have the supports they need, and also thinking about how to support parents and support women and mothers and fathers and other people who are responsible for children in being able to be employed as well as take care of their children.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, and in different countries, the issue or the problems that surface, you know, it may be one problem over another that surfaces in some place. It might be, like after World War II, there was a big interest in making sure that they could replace the population because so many people had died during the war, but they also need women to work. So there was more emphasis on paid family leave and also on building out an early childhood system. You know, in a lot of the European countries, but this is also happening in Asia and, you know, Africa and all North and South America, people are thinking about these issues. There's been this real interest in children's learning, and, you know, that Europe was really the home of the birth of the kindergarten and the Montessori movement on these early mid to late 19th century approaches to understanding that learning didn't just happen when children entered school at seven, but it was happening long before that, and what were ways to enhance children's development and learning before they started formal schooling. So many of the European countries, they took the initial kindergarten approach to heart, which was thinking about some kind of educational experience for children from age four to age seven, and they started their school systems just earlier. They started them at about four.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see in a lot of European nations in particular, I'm focused on Europe because I'm going there in 2 weeks on a trip to talk to people about these things.
Oh,
but
great.
It's true in other parts of the world now. I just
mm-hmm.
have Europe on the brain. You know, most of their formal education starts, not in every country, but it often starts at 4 or 5 years old. But in places like Finland and other places where it starts earlier, they've created a system of care and education for the years prior to that and sort of framed it as something that is a responsibility for the nation to take a look at. So what you see is, compared to other nations, we are one of the few countries that has, you know, almost no paid family leave for people, no national policy of paid family leave, that we, you know, we don't support with, you know, generous subsidies or don't create a public system around care and education. Now, it is true in some European countries, families also do pay for some of the care and education. But most of the European countries in the last 15 to 20 years have gone through major reforms, and they're trying to address issues of access and quality of education in a much more robust way than we are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because I've been, you know, thinking about these things for many years, and my really early work when I was myself in my 20s going, why doesn't the U.S. have a system? What you see is that we have been debating this issue of early care and education in the United States for 135 years, essentially. And really the terms of the debate have been, or the poles of the debate have been the same. Is it education? Is it care? Is it for the children of working mothers? Is it for all children? Is it to sort of socialize or Americanize some children? Or is it, you know, target to a particular group of children? Is it for everybody? Is it the government's responsibility? Is it the, family responsibility? Should it be run, you know, as a private enterprise? Should it be part of a public system? And these debates have been going on, and at different points in time, we have reform comes about when, and the questions get answered in one way or the other. But we've really never resolved these debates in the U.S., whereas other countries, they have resolved the debates, at least to some extent, better than we have, mm-hmm. so that they're trying not to split care and education as much, although some of the countries still do that. The Nordic countries do that much less. They really understand that if parents do pay something for the services, it's within the realm of sanity in terms of their family budgets. It's not going to drive poverty in families as child care costs do in the United States for many people. So I think it's just a very politicized, value-laden area of policy, and I think we saw a really good example of that during the presidential campaign, that the fact that there was a child care proposal put forth by the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign, I think, speaks to how sort of across the political spectrum, mm-hmm. people understand that this is something that isn't working very well in the U.S. But the reason we wrote that paper with the Economic Policy Institute was we really wanted people to be critical consumers of whatever proposals come across, you know, get put out there, because some will do nothing, really, or do almost nothing to, you know, help people with paid family leave in any meaningful way. Some will maybe relieve the cost burden for some families, but not all families, and maybe least of all for the families most in need. And some of the proposals might address quality, or they may actually drive quality down. So we at both our organization and Economic Policy Institute are very committed to making sure that the people who care about these issues become well-informed, active consumers of proposals that come our way. Mm-hmm. And that's why we wrote the paper.
Well, let's start with, we'll talk about quality in a moment. Let's talk about cost to begin here, because when I talk to people, my children are all grown now, but when I talk to young people who are having to use child care, the amount of money, and it's always been this way, that people have to pay a very large percentage of their salaries for decent child care. And you talk about how that's the case for lower income. You have to pay even more of what your salary is. If you want a place, and every parent does, that's good for your child, that's stimulating for your child, where you can feel comfortable leaving your child at work, it shouldn't be, you know, as much money as it is. Why are the costs so incredibly high? And I know people need to get paid for their work, but somehow, and it's important work for heaven's sake, but somehow there's a burden on families. There's not enough pay for the people who are caring for children. The whole system needs to be revamped somehow so people feel easy about this.
Right. And I think it's really good that you raise the issue of affordability, because that is the issue that it is most widely understood as a problem that has to be solved, often with the same question that you just posed. I would say the calls I get from reporters or different people, that is always, why is it so expensive?
Right.
And so I think there's a couple different answers to that. So one answer is that it really isn't that expensive, and actually, if we were paying people decently, it would be even more expensive. Mm-hmm. The reason we think of it as expensive is because people are paying for it themselves. If parents were paying for public schools, we would have exactly the same problem.
Yes.
So it's really not that expensive, but we just think it's that. You know, that's part of it. And part of the reason it is an expensive service, which in my opinion should be a public good, like K-12 education or K-12 education, keep fingers crossed that we will hold on to, is that it's a very labor-intensive service, mm-hmm. right? So the younger the children are, the higher your labor costs, theoretically. I mean, they aren't always higher than in K-12. We pay a lot more for K-12 than we do early childhood, even though we're paying more people's salaries. But if you have infants, you can't have one infant to 10 children. You can have one infant maybe to 10 preschoolers, but you can't have one infant to, one adult to three babies. Mm-hmm. You can't have one teacher to a group of 20 children and really expect to have a good program for 3- and 4-year-olds.
Right.
So part of it is just the labor costs, and which are not just pay, but benefits and support in the workplace for some of the duties that surround the actual direct time that you're caring for children. You have to plan what you're doing. You have to, you know, think about parent conferences, think about, you know, talking to other teachers about how to handle different issues. There are a lot of professional responsibilities that go with the work, as well as keeping your skills and knowledge up to date because of, you know, new things we learn about working with dual language learning children, for example, or whatever, integrating children with special needs, whatever the issue might be. And so I think that we don't really take into account the labor costs and all that surrounds it. And part of the reason we don't take in what surrounds it is we really don't believe that it's skilled work, right? So I think most people, when they hear, like, the National Academy of Sciences came out and said someone leading a group should actually have the same level of education and training as a K-12 teacher because the work of caring and educating 3- and 4-year-olds is every bit as complex as educating and caring for 10-year-olds. You know, I think people read that, but, you know, maybe really just don't think that that's true. I always want to, you know, sort of put them in a room with a group of 3-year-olds for a week straight, you know,
yes,
and,
right,
you know,
right,
40 hours, and then have them come back and sort of weigh in on that. And that's why you get pushback about, do teachers working with young children really need a, you know, a degree, or do they really need education, and those kinds of things. So I think, you know, that's part of it. But also that the way early care and education is delivered in the U.S. is primarily in very small, you know, nonprofit and for-profit community-based businesses, right? So there's no economy of scale when mm-hmm. it comes to benefits, purchasing. You know, I think someone told me that, I'm not sure this is exactly right, but it's about 50% of child care centers in the U.S. have less than 10 staff. So you have, you know, you have lots of small businesses which are precarious in terms of, it's just a precarious business model,
right,
without any kind of external help. So that there's nothing that breaks the link for most people between what parents are paying and the cost of the service, even a cost of service predicated on the low wages of the people doing it. Then you do have the government saying, well, we know some people need help with that. But government subsidies for child care serve a fraction of the people who qualify for them. And even amongst those who, you know, the requirement to qualify, most states have dropped it below what the Fed says is the ceiling for it because there's just not enough money in the system. And in, you know, states like ours, which is California, since probably true in Wisconsin as well, is that the amount we reimburse providers for providing those services is very, very low, which is, of course, keeps the quality low and, you know, sort of has all the problems that sort of basically accrue to the workforce. So I think the reason it's, in my opinion, the reason it's so expensive is because we're asking parents to shoulder the majority of the burden. We're not providing enough public support, and the public support we provide doesn't reach enough people, and it isn't at a high enough level. And so, you know, voila, there we are. You
mm-hmm.
know, and I think if we thought of it more like K-12 education as something that children were entitled to. In Europe, they talk about it as children's birthright. I think Germany just passed a law that said parents have a right to early care and education for their children from one going forward. You know, it would be a very different situation. And so that's part of why we are in the mess that we're in.
So do we need a model? And I know this has been hard for many states to get four-year-old programs, but there are publicly funded four-year-old kindergarten programs in many states now in the country. Should that be a model so that we're looking at publicly funded programs for children ages two and up?
Right. Well, so this is interesting. And I think actually Wisconsin actually has something about serving four-year-olds in your public education system in your constitution, like you're the only state that has that, I think. But there's been a big push over the last number of years about expanding public preschool, and I think now that there's 43 states have some kind of publicly funded preschool program. And in most states, it's just targeting four-year-olds. Some states, it's doing three- and four-year-olds. So, and I think the theory there is that, one, preschool education is an easier sell than childcare, which is, you know, one of these issues that just, you know, sets off bells and whistles for many people in many different directions. So, but one is that, that you start with four-year-olds and you go down to three-year-olds. And some people are thinking of it should be universal. Some want to target it. We also have Head Start for low-income kids, but we only serve about, I think, 40% of kids in Head Start who qualify for it. So, I mean, I think, you know, yes, on the face of it, expanding, you know, public pre-K and lifting the burden for families off of, you know, the child care burden off of families if they're in a public preschool program when their children are four, you know, is great. And you see in places where they're offering it, New York, Washington, Boston, different places, Oklahoma, when that's offered to families, families jump at it for many reasons, but cost is one of the reasons. The only problem is that the way, if you go back to thinking about childcare businesses, that the older the children are, essentially, they're sort of better for your business model because that you can have fewer adults. For them. So if you take out the oldest kids in a childcare center, so you're serving kids from, you know, 1 or 6 months to, you know, five, and you take those four-year-olds out of that equation, then that means your costs proportionately go up, and it's somewhat disruptive to the rest of the system. So, I mean, it seems to me that if you look at the brain science and you look at, you know, what we know about where the most sensitive periods of development are, we really do need a system that's funded, you know, from the point at which families need to utilize some kind of care and education, you know, up until school entry. And you can, you know, push back school entry and support public pre-K, which is great, but it's like you have to also have a plan at the same time to what you're going to do with the threes and the twos and the ones.
Mm-hmm. Marcy Whitebook is our guest this hour, director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at UC Berkeley. And we're talking about a major study that looks at childcare and what good childcare reform would look like in this country. What would it look like in your mind? What kind of childcare reform do we need? Many of you are in this situation, or you recently have been. It's very difficult in this country to find really good childcare. It's true, it's very important, but as our guest was saying, it's privately run, and so the cost of taking care of children, those workers should be paid even more than they are, but the parents of the child have to bear the responsibility, and for many, it's really a substantial cost. It costs a lot of money. Then we have the whole issue that we have not really gotten into yet when we talk about paid family leave. There are many, many families who have horrible paid family leave or no paid family leave when it comes to having a child. So we hear horror stories of moms returning to work very shortly after having given birth, and sometimes very difficult births. So the mother is at some health risk but feels as though she needs to bring home money. Fathers don't get much of a paternity leave. It's just a system that other countries do a lot better than we do. So how can we be better? Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'd like to read your messages there. And we're on Twitter at @KDunnShow. We'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Okay, our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest is Marcy Whitebook. She is the director of the Center for the Study of Child Care Employment at the University of California at Berkeley. And let's start our calls with Heather in Milwaukee. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
Yes, Heather, go right ahead.
I don't know how to phrase it, but this really comes close to heart. As a mom and as a working mom, when I first became a mom, I really, I found it almost embarrassing when I go to the parks with children and, you know, the question is, what do you do? And if I'm a stay-at-home mom, it's almost as though there's kind of this shame. And I thought about this a lot, and it's almost as though our culture nowadays is such that we really encourage women to work, but sometimes I think it's almost better if we stayed home with our kids. It does take a cut in how much we earn, but, you know, there's so many things that a parent can do for the child, and that probably, you know, dropping them off at daycares or having them, I've had children in pre-K, I have them in 4K through the public school system, but even then, they can't always reach to every child at that age the way that one-on-one parents can do.
Yeah, and I think that it's true that a lot of parents would, particularly those early months, it's just really hard to work and have your child not with you. But unfortunately, that's another issue in our society, I think. Don't you, Marcy, that a lot of people just have to work. So you feel the pressure of having to work to bring home an income and the pressure of making sure your child is doing all right. And then a sickness throws everything up in the air. It's just hard. But I think that most would agree that it'd be great if you can be at home with your children when they're very young.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the issue, that people should have options about how they organize their families and what they want to do. And I think that, you know, most families, you know, if have the opportunity to stay at home and, you know, have time at home with a new baby, for 3 months, 6 months, a year. I mean, we've lowered the bar in the U.S. We'd be happy if we could have 3 months. I mean, I think it's 30% of families in the U.S. have access to paid family leave. And even in California, where we have paid leave legislation, so if you can take paid leave, I think they're changing the law now, but the reimbursement, it comes out of our, everybody pays in as part of their, sort of state tax deductions. You only get about 50% of your salary. Well, for some people, you know, that they can manage that for a short period of time, or they have another income. But for a single mother, or for people who just have very limited income, and you put that next to the cost of housing and other things, it really just isn't an option not to be employed. So I think that's, you know, that, and I think so many of our policies around young children are not made based on what families think is best for their children, even in terms of the child care they choose or the preschools they choose. It's based on what they can afford. And there's something just fundamentally, for me, that, you know, unfair and inequitable about that, because it then becomes, you know, for children who there's a lot of resources in the family, they have a lot more options at their disposal. And, you know, you may say, well, for certain kinds of services, you know, you can, you know, you want to go to this restaurant, so I'm going to go to this fancier restaurant or not fancier restaurant, but what's at stake here is not the meal you're going to have. What's at stake here is your child's, mm-hmm. you know, experiences. So I think that, you know, absolutely having some form of, you know, paid leave and paid at a level that people can, is actually usable for people, because, you know, that it's not really a choice if you have this option of leave, but you can't
you have no way of
right.
really having any.
Right. And what are the percentages now in terms of how many people get paid leave? What percentage of the workforce does?
Well, it's, you know, it's interesting. It's sort of there's different data sources. So the one sort of point that everybody agrees on across data sources is that about 13% of families get paid family leave, but oh, I'm looking at my little Wisconsin folder here. I didn't mean to do that. Wait a minute. For paid family leave, I think we have in our report, we look at the percentage of families that have paid family leave by wage group. So, you know, at the bottom 10% of the income scale, about 4% of families have paid family leave.
4%?
Yes. And at the top 10% of the income scale, about 24% have it. So even families
right.
who have a lot of money don't necessarily get paid leave.
Mm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Aaron in West Bend. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show here.
Sure.
I have, just to preface this a little bit, I have 8 children of my own, the oldest being about 18, the youngest being about 2 months. And so in regards to paid family leave or even unpaid family leave, I firmly believe there's nothing better for the mother and the child for them to initially be together as much as they can, regardless of the cost. And I have had children go through preschool and 4K things, and I have had some who haven't. And the question I have for you is in regards to getting children into this kind of a fine line between daycare and pre-K in my mind at times with the more professional type daycares. But I'm wondering how much of this is truly, when we start getting into the much younger ages, 4, even 3, or as it's come up on your show, even younger than that, how much of it is truly, in your opinion, about the child's well-being and education, and how much of this is really being driven, do you feel, by getting the mother back into the workforce as fast as possible? Because I have seen studies that say that with the early childhood and the 3K, the 4K, yes, initially in school they start out doing a bit better, but by about third or fourth grade it all seems to kind of even itself out with the other children.
Mercy.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I think that, the way I tend to approach this question is we want children to have experience that optimize their development and learning. And what those options are have a lot to do with what their family needs. So children live in families. So for some families, they need, they need something that's going to be full day. Some family is going to need part day. Some needs to start it young. Some, you know, can wait a little older. And I think that it's really I think that some people think, oh, if you offer child care, you're going to incentivize people to work, like as if families wouldn't be making those choices anyway. And I think that what's driving families to work is primarily the economics of the livelihood of their family. So I think that the existence of child care is not what makes people use it, I don't think. I think that, you know, what we know is that when there aren't good options in the community, then children are often left in relatively unsafe, not great developmentally supportive situations for themselves. So to me, I think if parents really had a choice about leave and about the cost of childcare, we would, you know, then we would see what happens. In most of the European countries, when they've offered government-supported early childhood, they've increased their utilization rates a great deal. And you have, you know, up to about 95% of four-year-olds going to some kind of preschool, and you know, over half, you know, or the vast majority of three-year-olds also. So, you know, I think that if parents have the option for high-quality early childhood education, they may choose that for other, you know, I think they may, they're making that choice in part because they think that's something that will enhance their children's lives, but it's not a substitute for them being with their children as well.
Yeah, thanks, Erin, for the call. Your report makes mention of the Department of Defense child care program as mm-hmm. being one that we ought to look at. I found that interesting.
Right. Well, it's, you know, it's sort of funny that when people want to know, well, where's the best early care and education system in the U.S., it's in the Department of Defense. And that a number of years ago, in the late 80s, actually, the Department of Defense was very concerned about the quality of child care. They had very high turnover. It was very low quality, you know, and they really wanted to increase families coming into the military. And they understood that when families did not have good early care and education, you know, or child care services actually for older children too, that it was distracting to people, to soldiers and different people in the military, to doing their jobs. And they wanted to make sure that they had something that would really, you know, put people's mind at ease about their children being well taken care of and well educated. But they also, which is really interesting, they understood that many of their future soldiers were going to come from military families, and they wanted to really figure out how to build the best experiences to enhance the development of what they saw in many ways as their future workforce. So they totally revamped their system, and they broke the link between what parents paid and how much the people working in the system were charged. So the parents pay, I think it's around 10% of their income, no matter what their income level is, for the services. And then for the care itself, they put in very clear requirements for the people working and quality requirements of the programs, and they figured out, well, this is what that will cost, this is how much we're going to get from parents, and then, you know, the military actually pays the difference between what really high-quality service, the cost of high-quality services and what families have access to. And the teachers working in those systems are paid like other comparably educated federal employees based on their level of, you know, skill and knowledge. So I think they really put into place the principles that,
yes,
you know, we think are pretty fundamental to good child care reform.
Mm. Interesting. Erin in East Troy is next. Hi, Erin.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm just curious, listening to this conversation, how Montessori or other alternative child care formats could be utilized. You know, I know in Montessori, the ideal includes a higher child-to-worker ratio, so even at the preschool level, you can have, I think it's 1 to 15 by Montessori standards versus, you know, some of the other high ratios for younger children.
Marcy?
So I'm just want to make sure I understand your question. Are you saying could we address costs by increasing the ratios, because there are some models for that?
Yeah, have you looked at alternative models, you know, versus just a more standard, whether it's a family style, whether it's a Montessori style, whether it's a more traditional age-segregated style program?
Right. My own personal opinion, and I haven't, you know, studied this per se, is that I actually think that there's a lot of ways to do good early care and education. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all. And I think, you know, you can do Montessori, there's different models all around the world and even in the United States. I think the issue is with the ratios has something to do with how much training people have. And so, you know, Montessori teachers are very rigorously trained. But, you know, in the United States, that is not necessarily the case. And the National Academies of Science came out with a report in 2015 where, based on their review of the science, they recommended that everybody working with young children, whether it was in a home-based center or home-based family child care or in a center, had some foundational knowledge in early childhood. And that didn't mean, like, 20 clock hours it meant, some course of study so that they, not necessarily a degree, but something that was a coherent introduction to learning and development and pedagogy. And then they said at the highest level someone should have, if someone's leading a group, they should have the equivalent of a bachelor's or higher degree. And if you look across the states, most states do not have that foundational threshold, and very few states have that the higher level BA requirement. So in the U.S. right now, Hawaii, Mississippi, Georgia, New Jersey, and Illinois have basically have those. They're making headway, and they require that minimum of a degree for pre-K teachers and at least what we call a child development associate or a vocational training for licensed child care providers. But there are, you know, a number of states, including Wisconsin, I'm trying to count them up here, but there's, you know, about half the states don't have either of those things. So I think part of the issue, and, you know, people talk about the French system, too, where they have, you know, fewer teachers to a particular number of children, it has something to do with the supports they have in the workplace for the people doing the work and their level of training. But oftentimes what, you know, you hear is, well, let's just up the ratio without really addressing those other issues. And then, of course, if you're trying to work with a large group of children or really any group of children, if you don't have that education and training, it's a much more challenging job to do well. And if you don't have support, you know, everything as basic as time for a break to some time to step back and think about what you're going to do with the children the next day, it's really hard to provide high-quality early care and education.
Mm-hmm. Marcy, why is it that you mentioned the military and the model the military has? Why haven't, and maybe they have and I'm unaware of it, why haven't U.S. businesses really stepped up here? Women are in the workforce in huge numbers and making valuable contributions, and they tend to be still the primary caretakers of children. Why aren't there a whole lot of business-sponsored daycare?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. Where you see, I mean, I think for many, I mean, the entire time I've been in the field, which is, you know, multiple decades now, people have been talking about employer-sponsored child care or employer support. And it's kind of, it's like there's a little of it going on, but it's really never taken hold. Mm-hmm. And I think where you tend to see it the most is in the high-end companies, you know, Google. Or, you know, like they have a fabulous child care center, you know, where they invest a lot in supporting their employees. I think, you know, most women are working in low-wage jobs, or not all, I don't know if it's most, but a high proportion of women are working in low-wage jobs, and, you know, there is not, you know, employers have either can't because their business model won't allow it, or they don't think it's necessary to, it's not something that they have to offer to attract and retain their employees. So, you know, it hasn't taken hold, although what I would say is that the business community in the last number of years has been more actively pushing for public child care reform. So I think it'll be interesting to see how, you know, things play out. If we actually do move forward with some kind of child care reforms, you know, in the coming period. But, you know, it hasn't taken hold because I think in a way this is this problem that always gets pushed to the back burner. You know, people, like if you read why, you know, to me it's a little bit like climate change. Like people go, oh, the science is pretty clear that this is something that we need to be dealing with. And yet, you know, to really deal with it means we have to stop doing certain things, we have to start doing other things, and we have to get really innovative. And I think we have little inklings of that. In every state, people are trying to come up with innovations and try and do things. But fundamentally, if we don't commit more resources to the issue of early care and education and family leave the early years of children's lives, we can fiddle with it. We can rearrange things a little bit and maybe make it a little better for some kids over there and some kids over here. But fundamentally, we're left with this system where it's inequitable for families in terms of how much mm-hmm. they pay, for kids in terms of what they get, and certainly for the people doing the work.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Jill in McGuanago. Hi.
Hi. I would like to say several things. everything that you have stated is so accurate. I'm 62 years old, and I'm an RN, and I went through this in the 70s, that even as a hospital worker, there wasn't enough sponsored daycare centers for our infants to even get in. My daughter lost her four-month-old baby 2 years ago in an in-home adult family-known caregiver left unattended for 3 hours and suffocated from a blanket. We don't know that. Their homeowner's insurance doesn't provide any compensation. You know, we are really in a dangerous situation. And like you said, it's the lower income. We have these $80,000 college educations. We need to work. The divorce rate, we can't risk our jobs and starting all over after 10 years. And for one thing, those who, mothers who can afford to stay home and not work, do you know that they get more in Social Security from their husband's higher wages and they never paid a dime into the system? So, you know, we really need to stand up for women's rights. I guess that's all I want to say.
All right. I'm so sorry your daughter went through that. It's tragic.
Yeah.
Marcy.
I'm so sorry for you and your whole family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really unconscionable that we have the situation we have in the United States. And I agree with you. I think that women, you know, are continuing to bear the burden of a lot of this.
Let's go next to Winona in DeForest. Hi, Winona.
Hi. So earlier I had heard that you guys were kind of talking about how the cost of daycare currently, although it's high, it's what it should be. And I just was wondering, what is that price point? Because, I mean, I have a four-year-old and a one-year-old, and I have daycares that'll tell me for a whole week full-time care is $450, and then there's another daycare that's two blocks from my house that's $830. What's fair? And then I also had another second point about the Montessori schools that in Madison, they're the same prices as most of the daycares in Madison. There's not a huge difference. And why is it that the Montessori schools, with all their extra training and the higher amount of teachers and all the extra education that your children are getting, why is it the same price as just a standard daycare where they're getting paid $11 an hour?
Marcy is
thinking
about it.
What the two questions are, because, I mean, I think, you know, in most communities, there is a range of how much, you know, the cost of child care, which sometimes, you know, is based on how much they're paying the people. Sometimes it's based on, you know, the relationship of the business to the place in which it's being conducted. It's rented or it's owned. Sometimes it's the economy of scale, like how many kids they have, which gives them a little more flexibility with costs. Sometimes it's the neighborhood they're in and what they think they can charge a group of parents, you know, to some extent. But, you know, I don't know your particular community, but, you know, and I don't know with the Montessori program that you referred to what the difference is to the earlier caller's comment about ratio, if that might have something to do with it. So it might have something to do with the level of training the teachers have and how much they're paying the teachers. I mean, there's just a lot of factors that go into it. But I think the main problem is that for most families, the percentage of the percentage of their income, particularly if they have more than one child using child care at the same time, the child care cost is, you know, just over and above any other cost they have. It can be far more than their mortgage or whatever. So it's sort of and that is one thing about the Army, the way they've set it up, that a family pays 10% of their income for child care, regardless of how many children they have. So if you have three kids under five, you're still paying 10% of your income as opposed to 10% of your income for each child, which would be 30% of your income.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. Winona, thank you very much for your call. We're talking this hour about child care in the country and asking the question, what would good child care reform actually look like? Marcy Whitebook is part of a study on this and a report that has just been released by the Center for the Child Care Workforce. She's director of that center and has taught in early childhood programs for many years, and she has led many early childhood research projects. So how do you answer that question for you and for your family or for the country? What about child care reform? What do we need to put in place? Why is it so darned expensive for so many families? And the less money you make, the greater percentage of your take-home pay is spent on child care. What can be done about that? Other countries have much more generous policies, and we're looking at what kind of policy would be good for this country and how we implement it. We have lines open right now. They've been crowded. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network. Marcy Whitebook is our guest now. We're talking about child care in this country, and we go to Naomi in Madison next. Hello, Naomi.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm calling. I have two small kids. I have a 4-year-old and a 16-month-old, and they are in daycare part-time, but I'm actually moving to put them with a nanny, because even as we're paying a living wage for our nanny, we're going to be paying $15 an hour and paying taxes and Social Security and all that stuff. That's going to be cheaper for us than having my kids in daycare full-time, which
really
seems ridiculous, but I'm paying a nanny directly, and yet that is going to be cheaper than, you know, getting them daycare, which I would rather do. I'd rather have them have the socialization, but just cost-wise, we can't swing it.
Mm. Right. I just wanted to draw your attention to, you know, to your listeners' attention to, well, our little article, but also if you go to the, within there, there's a, you know, interactive website you can get to. If you look at it on computer, you can go to the Economic Policy Institute website. But they basically look at each state, what the share of families that can afford child care. So for infant care, in Wisconsin, they estimate that 21% of families can afford infant care, and the annual infant care is about $11,000.
Goodness.
A year. And for 4-year-olds, which describes your family, Naomi, there's about 30% of families are able to afford 4-year-old care, and the average cost is about $9,500 a year. They don't really talk about how many, I don't know what the hours are, whatever, but you can see that. I mean, I think that that ends up happening, that for many families, hiring someone privately becomes, it's more convenient. It might fit with people's hours more, and actually, when they have multiple children, becomes a choice they have to make. So, again, I think this issue of what parents end up choosing for their children is so driven by cost, and that rather than thinking about their child and what would be the setting that they would prefer for their children. And so, I mean, I think, you know, really in part why we wrote our piece, and, you know, what I would say to your listeners is that many decisions about early care and education, not all of them, but are decided locally, and I would really encourage people to get involved in trying to sort of raise these issues as part of, you know, efforts that we work on locally to come up with some new solutions.
Mm. Thanks, Naomi, so much. One more call. Gary. Oh, Gary's not there in Wisconsin Dells. The report, how can people find your lengthy report on this? You mentioned that we should give people a place to go, Marcy.
Yes, so you can get the report at our website, which is cscce.berkeley.edu.
Okay.
And, yeah, the report is called, it's right on our homepage, What Does Good Child Care Reform Look Like? You can also get the report at epi.org, which is Economic Policy Institute, and they have it on their webpage. Or you probably can just type it into Google and say, what does good child care reform look like? And it will come up for you. And then this has a lot of the information about the facts about paid family leave, child care costs, and child care quality. And there's some interactive maps embedded into the article. And our website also, if you want to look a little more closely about what's happening to child care teachers and preschool teachers in your state, also has a map where you can click on Wisconsin and get a lot of details about your system.
Great. And in just the 40 seconds or so we have left, you've been in the field a long time. What progress have we made?
There's good days and bad days for me to answer that question. What I think the progress we've made is that many, many more people understand why this is a critical public policy issue, that requires reform, and many more, you know, now we have generations of people saying this is intolerable, and I'm hoping we're going to get to a critical mass pretty soon that we'll really start to see some innovative policies that really will be based on meeting the needs of the vast majority of us instead of just a few.
Thanks, Marcy, so much. Quite informative.
Thank you.
Marcy Whitebook, Director of the Center for the Study of Childcare Employment at the University of California at Berkeley. And the study has just been published. It is What Does Good Childcare Reform Look Like? We thank her for her time. Thanks to Chris Molina for producing this hour. And thanks to Colleen Duvall for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. News is coming up in just a moment from National Public Radio. We'll be with you again tomorrow, and that will be our normal hours, 1 o'clock until 3 o'clock. We'll talk about white privilege during the course of this hour. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your participation, as always. This is the Ideas Network.